History Show with Moz Duncan.
Good evening and welcome to the History Show on RTE Radio 1. On this week's programme...
We didn't think anything was going on, only that we were doing the laundries. We used to throw the cigarettes and all over to the young ones that was there.
Memories of life in inner city Dublin. We'll hear about a new oral history project which collects the testimony, memories and experiences of people from the area. Also, remembering the acclaimed photographer Bill Doyle, celebrated for his ability to capture extraordinary images of ordinary Irish life. Plus,
he protested before God and the Virgin his utter innocence of the crime.
Language, life and death in 19th century Ireland. The case of Muire Sheoga, the Gaeltacht man who was brutally executed in 1882 for a crime he didn't commit. It's 51551 for your texts and at RTE History Show on Twitter. But we begin this evening in South Africa, where it was 70 years ago that the system of apartheid began. The laws made white people officially superior, creating separate public facilities, transport and schools for the black majority. The policy only ended in 1994, the same year Nelson Mandela was elected the country's first black president. Rona Tarrant has been speaking to one man who lived through the regime. He speaks about the long struggle to end apartheid and the role Ireland played in the fight.
Our policy is one which is called by an Afrikaans word apartheid.
Though the word apartheid was first introduced to the wider world in 1948, separating black Africans from the white minority had long been a policy aim.
And I'm afraid that has been misunderstood so often. It could just as easily, and perhaps much better, be described as a policy of good neighbourliness.
South Africa's Prime Minister Hendrik Verwoerd said the policy was misunderstood, but in reality it created discrimination for the black majority in every aspect of their lives. Thulani Mabaso's first memories of the system were formed when he was 8 years old.
My grandmom, she was always mourning about her livestock that was forcibly taken away from them.
His family grew up on one of the many townships for black South Africans.
No ablution, no toilets, and the one tap out of 500 family, one tap of water.
Conflict with authorities was constant.
At schools, mostly being constantly harassed by police, just come unannounced with dogs, the big dog called Alsatians, throwing some tear gas canister, people run out of the window. And then some of my schoolmates disappeared. We started to, as a group of school kids children, we started to say, hey man, something must be done.
By the time Thulani was 15, he left school to join the armed resistance wing of the African National Congress, or the ANC.
I went for training, guerrilla warfare. Even my training, we was well indoctrinated. We were told, your enemy can be your mother, your sister, your brother. They're not a race. Because us, we only see the white person as an enemy.
Thulani soon became involved in violent activity. In 1983, when he was 19, he walked into a Defence Forces building in Johannesburg and planted an explosive device.
And then we informed them that there's an explosive on the second floor. They must evacuate using the staircase, not the lift. Indeed, we saw them moving out. And then 1 minute past three in the afternoon, then the explosive took place.
57 people were injured. 3 months later, Thulani was arrested.
And then I was taken to John Foster Square, most notorious police station. I was then severely tortured there.
He received an 18-year prison sentence and in 1985 was transferred to Robben Island, where Nelson Mandela was also a prisoner. Conditions were poor and Thulani soon became a leader in hunger strikes.
To change the diet, you must remember that we were given a different diet scale. Diet for blacks, diet for coloured and Indians. We had 29 demands. They met 20 of the demands. And then we said, well, we are suspending. I was even given the nickname Black Bobby Sands.
Despite being on an island in South Africa, the prisoners received regular news about the troubles in Northern Ireland and felt an affinity to the cause.
It was the biggest ever Republican funeral with thousands of Bobby Sands supporters from all over Ireland arriving.
They also received word of the Dunn Stores workers who refused to handle South African produce in a protest over apartheid policies.
Then to us, it was very much encouraging and said, oh, we are not alone.
Dulani served 6 years in Robben Island and was eventually released in 1991 as part of a deal negotiated by the ANC. He subsequently worked as an organiser with the group and in 1994 witnessed his fellow former inmate Nelson Mandela become the country's first black president.
And never again shall it be that this beautiful land will again experience the oppression of one by another.
In 2002, Dulani returned to Robben Island, this time to work as a tour guide on what is now a UNESCO World Heritage Site.
Even now, I still feel emotional.
Here, in the hallways and cells where Dulani lived as a prisoner, he now greets tourists and world leaders and tells them his story.
People need to know. You can read the history book, but as long as we're still alive, we need to rewrite our history so that the new generation, they don't commit the same mistake.
Rona Tarrant was reporting there. She was speaking to Dulani Mabaso, who is now a tour guide at Robben Island, where he was once a prisoner and where Nelson Mandela was imprisoned for 18 years of his incarceration. And if you want to hear more about Ireland's connections to South Africa, the Nelson Mandela exhibition is running at Kilmainham Jail in Dublin until January. It's 51551 for your texts. And for the last 10 weeks, an oral history course has been run out of Charleville Library in Dublin's North Inner City, supported by the North East Inner City Initiative and Dublin City Council. It was open to residents from that area of Dublin. The project focuses on the collection of oral testimony, memories and life experiences of people born into the area or who've spent much of their lives in that part of our capital city. And I'm joined in studio now by three guests, Aideen Leonard, Mary Kennedy and Sonia Shannon, all of whom have been recording interviews with local people and collecting their experiences and memories. You're all very welcome indeed to the History
Show.
Thank
you. Thanks very much.
Aideen, tell us first of all about the project and how you got involved.
Well, this is a funny story about this. I thought that I had seen the leaflet in Charleville Mall Library and then told Mary Kennedy about it. But Mary kindly reminded me the other day that it was the opposite way around.
Right.
That actually Mary saw the leaflet in Charleville Mall and told me about it. So that's how I found out. I do use my library a lot. I'd be there on nearly a weekly basis and they always have their leaflets out. So I saw this and I thought this would be just a fascinating, really enjoyable course, you know, because the North Inner City is such a vibrant area. I've lived in it now for 20 years. I absolutely love it. I love the community I'm in. And I thought, what better way to celebrate living in the North Inner City than to, you know, record some of the stories of our older generation there? So I jumped at the chance to do it.
Is that how you got involved, Sam? We know how Mary got involved. Obviously, it was the same leaflet. Is that how you got involved?
I actually seen it on Facebook.
Yeah.
A local historian, Terry Fagan, shared it on his Facebook. And I just looked at it and thought, yeah, I'd actually like to do that. I'm from the North Inner City. So.
And what... Obviously, you know, it was a lengthy enough course, detailed enough course. Presumably you learned a lot more, Mary, than how to turn on a tape recorder and how to turn it off.
Yeah, so the beginning of the course was based around history. So people who had already done oral history projects. We had a couple of historians in who were really informative. And then we had a couple of weeks where we talked about the morals of the recording, the ethics and the legal side of it.
Okay, explain that to me, the ethics of recording somebody's
memory.
So
it's like, who owns the recording? The recording is not mine. It's the person who you've interviewed. It's their recording. You need to get consent that they totally understand where the recording can be used. And you explain all this to them. They still have the final consent after that, whether it goes into the archives
or not. So if they realise that they've said something that they don't want other people to know about, they can say no, right, that's
it. Or you could edit it out, or maybe they might decide they just don't want it to go anywhere. Mm-hmm. So the final consent is theirs. And this was where the morals came in. Even though legally they've signed a consent form, morally it is their, their right to refuse.
Aideen, a big theme in these interviews seems to be social life, cultural change. Mm-hmm. Tell me about one person that you spoke to, somebody called Joan Phelan. We'll be hearing from her shortly.
Yes, I've known Joan since I moved into the area. She ran a sort of a really traditional old style little local shop on St. James's Avenue in Ballybock with her husband. And it, the shop was just like stepping back in time. When you walked in the door of that shop, you could be in any little village anywhere in Ireland. Joan was a country woman herself, but she had come to Dublin at age 10. You'd never think it by her accent, but she, you know, she ran that shop. But it was more than a shop. It was like a little cultural exchange area. It was where people came to chat after mass. People came to drop in leaflets and, you know, if there was something going on in the parish, you'd go to Joan's shop, she'd have the poster up. It was a real place where people not just went into shop, but stopped to chat, you know, hear about their neighbours, hear about maybe somebody who died. The first place you'd hear it would be in Joan's shop. So it was more than a shop. It was a real sort of fulcrum for the community.
The great thing, of course, about a project like this is it's not a law court. So therefore, hearsay is very important. And I would imagine someone like Joan would have heard an awful lot in addition to having experienced a lot herself.
Absolutely. You know, she would, yeah, she was sort of like a sounding board, I suppose, for other people in the community. People would come to her even with problems and advice. You know, I remember her telling me lots of, you know, people would come in even looking for, if they were in trouble and they'd run out of money for their groceries, Joan would have an awful lot of people on tab and they'd pay her whenever they had it.
Mm. Okay, we'll hear an extract from your interview with Joan Phelan. Here, a couple of them actually. Here you are asking her about one of her favourite pastimes as a young woman.
I used to go dancing. We love dancing, actually. I danced 7 nights a week if I had money, but and there was no bars in or anything in the dance halls. You could have maybe a cup of tea or a glass of orange or something.
So, Joan, describe to me what it was like getting ready to go out to a dance. What was the routine?
Oh, the routine was I had to have my, I washed my hair, put in my rollers. Now, you didn't wear much makeup in those days because you didn't have the money for it. Probably had a bit of lipstick and maybe a bit of powder or something. And high heels, as high as I could get them. Because I was only 5'2". So, and I was about 18, like, before I was allowed to go out dancing.
And Joan couldn't dance 7 days a week, not just because she didn't have the money, but also because she spent most of her time working.
When I was working in Bolton Street, in that shop, and when I was about 16, I suppose, I got a job in the Palm Grove Cafe in the evening after work, and I worked there until it closed at night.
So you worked two jobs that time?
I worked two jobs because I was the oldest of a family of 10, and I used to have to send home money to them for to dress them for confirmation or First Communion or whatever. And also, my mother had to get all her teeth out, so I contributed, bought her first set of dentures.
I see what you mean about the accent, by the way. That does not sound like someone who only spent the first 10 years of her life living down the country.
No, it's remarkable, yeah.
Extraordinary, yeah. The way she hung on to the accent. That was the voice of Joan Phelan there. Sonia, the interviews also include observations on local institutions. And one of your interviewees, Chrissy Byrne, spoke about the Magdalen Laundry on Sean McDermott Street. Like many of the people interviewed, she was someone you knew from living in the area. So tell us a little bit about Chrissy.
Well, Chrissy, she's lived in the inner city all her life. She lived in Dublin tenements, in the old tenements. And in her interview, she just talks about life in the tenements and growing up and the area and everything that was in it. And just life was so simple. And then she talks about the Magdalen Convent. The flat complex that she lived in, it overlooked the yard of the convent. So Chrissy remembers the girls calling up and asking her for cigarettes, and she used to throw cigarettes.
And how far back could she take you in terms of living in the tenements? I mean, roughly speaking, roughly what, I don't know exactly what age she is, but what decade is she in?
Well, Chrissy is in her 80s,
right?
So she was born in the inner city. So right from when she was very young, there was 14 of them in our family. They lived in a 2-bedroom, so she could remember just having an open fire, nothing else, no electricity, you know.
So it's almost Sean O'Casey, really, isn't it? Not, I mean, it's a little bit after Sean O'Casey, but it had, things wouldn't have changed all that much.
Yeah.
Okay, let's hear from Chrissy Byrne talking to Sonia about her memories of the site where the Magdalen Laundry once operated on Sean McDermott Street.
We didn't think anything was going on, only that we were doing the laundries. But we never, nobody ever put anything to it till all this come out. We used to throw the cigarettes and all over to the young ones that was there. There was a big square at the back of the convent when they come out on their break, and we used to throw them over. We'd be talking from the windows, from the flats. But nobody knew what was going on. Nobody.
Did you ever meet any of the girls from there?
I knew a couple of them now that. They were put in for school. There was an awful lot put in for school. And then the poor girls that was brought up from the country where they had babies, their parents put them in, but they were signed in. Anyone who was signed in couldn't get out.
Did they interact with the people in the community?
No, no. So nobody saw them. You see, they were all in the back doing the laundries for the hotels and hospitals and all the whole day. You never saw them. You only saw the nuns when you were going in to collect your clothes.
And that was Chrissy Byrne recalling her memories of the Magdalen Laundry in Dublin's northeast inner city. Sonia also spoke to Paddy Malone, and he shared his memories of growing up as a pupil at the Artane Industrial School, a fairly grim establishment.
Yeah, Paddy Malone, I didn't actually know Paddy was in the Christian Brothers before I interviewed him. That's something that just came out when I started talking to him. But Paddy was born in a Magdalen convent. And he was moved from there to an orphanage in Kilkenny, and then moved from Kilkenny then to
So he had a great start in life.
Yeah, so he was there until he was 16. And then once you're 16, then they just, that's it, bye-bye.
Okay, well, we'll talk about the bye-bye afterwards, but let's hear an extract from your interview with Paddy Malone, where he talks about life at the school, at Artane Industrial School.
You were a number, more or less. You were always referred to by a second name. We never referred to by a first name, which is more or less being a number. You got up in the morning and either breakfast or mass first, I can't remember which, you know, but there was a religious service every morning, breakfast then, which with 800 people, so you can imagine what it was like. You know, everything was just mass produced and, you know, nothing of nutritious benefit as such. And if there was, it was mass-produced and it was burnt or overcooked or, you know, because they were cooking for so many. And it was just put in front of you. And it was a battle to eat, you know. Whoever was senior on the table, there was about 20 people on each table. So whoever was tops on the table got preference and, you know, and you didn't complain, you know. But the regime, it was Christian Brothers, and the regime was absolutely brutal. And the interesting thing was that you accepted it because you knew no better. And that was always the thing about institutional care, particularly from a young age. If you were in care from a young age, you didn't experience the usual family emotional feelings that other children did. You never realised what you missed out until after you were 16 years of age.
Very, very tough first 16 years of Paddy Malone's life. Very hard to listen to, I have to say. Harrowing and emotional description there of life growing up in the Artane Industrial School. And then he leaves at 16. And what happens?
He left at 16 and he went to a hostel in Ecclestree for young men. And when he was in the hostel, he realised that there was nothing for any of the kids to do. He went out to work and then there was nothing to do later on in the night. So he set up a kind of a club, a youth club, within the hostel. And he put billboards and snooker or whatever it was at the time for the kids. And then from then, Paddy volunteered and is still volunteering. He's retired now in youth work and minding kids and making sure to get everything that he didn't get in Artane Industrial School.
Yeah.
He's an incredible man.
Yeah, Mary, you spoke to a man called Michael Denver, and he wasn't a pupil at Artane, but he did recall visiting there. Just tell us a little bit about Michael first before we hear this clip.
Okay, so Mick Denver, he's a neighbour. I know him a fairly long time. He's a character. So he had no problem doing the interview. He was very happy to do it. He's great. His memories are great. Like during the different parts of the interview, he can name every shop that used to be in the area, families who lived where, everywhere, you know. He's a brilliant memory. But his uncle, he used to work after school with his uncle who had a confectionery business. And he used to help him deliver things. And then when he started serving his apprenticeship as a carpenter, he used to work with his uncle in the evenings just to earn a few bob. So I think one of the clips is
because it relates back to what Sonia was saying about Artane and to Paddy Malone. Who knows? It may even involve Paddy Malone, but we'll see. We'll hear from Mick Denver speaking to Mary, and he describes visiting the Artane school with his uncle.
I went into Artane as a young fella because my uncle used to deliver confectionery sweets to the shop, the tuck shop, as it was called. And when I was walking with him, I'd go in there into the, and I'd see all the young fellas in the short trousers, tweedy type suits on them, and the hobnail boots. And the young fellas would come around with the handcart, and we'd load up all the toffee bars and all the stuff, big orders like. And they'd run around to the tuck shop. We'd load the cart, and they were going around to empty it to come back again. And I noticed one young fellow standing in the doorway, and when the cart was going by, the fella slowed up, and that man pulled a box of sweets off it. And of course, I said, what's this? They're robbing our sweets. And I said to my uncle, I said, does that fella have to take in a box of sweets? He said, I know, they always do that. We don't mind that. That was a little treat to young fellows. If they were caught doing that, they were in serious trouble.
And that was Mick Denver, and as I say, he could have been talking, that could have been Paddy Malone who was, nicking the sweets, and a little bit, a very small amount of pleasure for him. Mary, you interviewed also somebody called Eileen MacDonald, and she remembered the Great North Strand floods of 1954, which I have to say is something I've never ever heard of. So we'll hear a short extract first.
Back then in 1954, with the floods, you had no insurance. How did you manage?
We had house insurance for fire and theft.
But not for flooding?
Oh, no, no.
And how did you replace everything?
How did we? We didn't. My father used to go up and buy second-hand things anywhere he could get furniture and bring it, because we didn't have a car, and he'd get a man up the road there to bring down this and that and the other.
And you actually remember those floods yourself from your childhood?
I do, yeah. I remember the water coming up. I was quite young. The water coming up. We lived at the top of a hill, and I was in Clontarf at the time. But I do remember the water coming to the bottom of the road. But afterwards, I've seen photographs of rowing boats in North Strand. People being taken out of buildings on other people's shoulders. There's quite a big.
It was the seawater.
It was. I think the railway bridge collapsed into the Talca. And the Talca overflowed, but it must have been very high tides because the whole of the seafront was flooded as well. So I think the water was coming in from everywhere. It was very serious, but they've had constant floods since then. And the houses where Eileen lives, they have basements, and they've suffered constantly from flooding and still can't get flood insurance.
Before we go, we're going to hear one more story from Mick Denver. This is quite an amusing story, actually. He recalls his own experience of television arriving in Ireland.
I remember a fellow around the Spring Garden Passage. I used to knock around with him. Dermot Higgins was his name. And he was the only child in the house. But they got a television. And you could see nothing on it. Absolutely nothing, because there was no television station here, no RTE or anything like that. Signals had come from Northern Ireland, and they'd be trying to pick them up here, and all you see was snow, and occasionally you might get a glimpse of a person, you know, very hard to see. But even at that, we used to sit down and watch it, and all the other kids in the street, they wouldn't let into the house. But they'd be all outside the window, and the curtains would be open, and they'd be all looking in at the television. And that's how we got our enjoyment there with that. And then I remember we got our own television. And when Telefishearn came in, and we'd sit around looking at that. That was in Spring Garden Street now. But I remember a girl came one time, knocked at the door, and she had a new gimmick for the television. And it was like a big magnifying glass that you put in front of the television and it made the screen bigger. I don't know how much it was, but everyone bought them. They were useless. Absolutely useless.
Great story there from Michael Denver. And you, Mary, you reckon a lot of people you talk to, you don't remember them yourself, but other people
do. No, but I did relate the story to several people, and last night I was just actually talking to Eileen's husband, Eileen's daughter, and Eileen's daughter's husband said they had one as well, that everybody had these magnifying things.
Small television screens, but
a little television. They were only small tellies, and then you had this big magnifying glass thing in front of it.
And you probably had to, you had to be the next street to be able to see them properly. Right. Nice idea, but just doesn't work. Aideen, are you going to keep doing this?
Absolutely. I had no idea I'd enjoy it so much, and I want to keep going now. There's so many other amazing people. I interviewed another man called Paddy Tucker, who lives beside St. Agatha's Church, and Paddy had the most incredible memory and hilariously funny stories. And like Mary, he remembered every shop. He remembered characters like Hector Gray and a man who used to tear telephone books in half, and, you know, characters that came and entertained the children in the North Inner City, and street games, all of that kind
Hector
of stuff.
Hector Gray was the great salesman.
That's right. Yes. But definitely want to keep doing it.
Okay. Right. And the same with you, Sonia, and you, Mary, as well. Yeah. You'll keep at it.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Loved it. Okay. Well, sure. We'll have you back. Maybe give it a year or so. We'll have you back and see what you've come up with between now and then, and maybe track down a few more of those poor unfortunates who were sold magnifying glasses
or cellophane to make the black and white. They cellophane. Had cellophane in front, coloured cellophane. To make a black and white television colour.
I want to hear that one. I don't want to hear that one, how that one worked out. Oral history projects, very important at preserving the living memory of our history. And Aideen Leonard, Mary Kennedy, Sonia Shannon, many thanks for joining us this evening and sharing those extracts from the interviews. And do come back, give it a year or so, do come back and we'll see what you've come up with. All of the interview recordings collected by participants in the course will be deposited with Dublin City Library and Archive, and they'll be preserved and made publicly accessible early next year. Thank the three of you all very, very much.
Thank you. Thanks very much.
After the break, we'll be remembering one of Ireland's most acclaimed photographers, Bill Doyle.
Follow us on Twitter at RTE History Show.
Welcome back. 51551 for your texts. Just a quick word about Tulton, a two-day festival of sport and sports writing, which is taking place next weekend in Kells in County Meath. One event that may be of interest to our listeners, the UCD historian and regular guest on this programme, Paul Rouse, will be giving a talk entitled How Journalists Created the GAA. That's taking place this coming Saturday, 1st of December, at the Kells Theatre at 1:30. And for more information, go to hinterland.ie. Time now for another installment in our occasional series, Here's the Thing, where Julian Clancy uncovers the stories behind some of the objects on display in the Little Museum of Dublin. Tonight, he's looking at a series of photographs from one of Ireland's most acclaimed photographers.
There are a lot of wonderful photographs of the capital scattered around the Little Museum of Dublin. Some of the most powerful shots, though, are by Bill Doyle, who sadly passed away in 2010.
I was astonished to know that he was in his 80s when he died. I thought he was a young guy. I thought he was in his late 60s or 70s.
That's Anthony Farrell, founder of Lilliput Press, who's published two collections of Bill's work, including Images of Dublin, A Time Remembered. It was from this book that a number of shots were selected to hang in the museum. Taken over different decades, they all share the same unique quality.
I think just the tenderness and the ability to capture a moment frozen in time.
As a child, Bill was always fascinated with cameras, and he was largely self-taught. His career really took off, though, in 1967, when he entered and won the Daily Telegraph magazine Photographer of the Year award. Working from his studio on Stephen's Green, Bill walked or cycled everywhere, capturing ordinary Dubliners with extraordinary photographs.
Bill was just very much a man of the people, and he would photograph people at mass or people walking the roads, working in the fields. He'd never set anything up. He just captured life on the wing.
Bill's photography is in black and white, and he would often pay as much attention to how these shots were developed to what they were of And it's this attention to detail that brings a timelessness to these photographs that's spellbinding.
There's a woman in Bewley's with her little finger raised drinking a cup of tea, but with her poodle on her lap. And she's looking fixedly away from camera, and the dog's looking directly at camera. And yet it's tender, you know, it's there's a huge vulnerability in that woman.
Bill can often be seen walking around the streets of Dublin, and if the light was right and you passed him by, you could actually find yourself in the middle of one of his shots. One picture, taken in 1979, is of three punks dressed in torn jeans, leather jackets, tight cropped hair. There's also an elderly man walking past. Glasses, a peaked cap, overcoat, and a look of sheer contempt on his face.
Well, he literally walked into the frame, saw Bill taking the photograph, and then went up to him and muttered some profanity about these three. And he really despised these people. But again, they're framed by the arch, and it's a perfect shot.
As much as the shots were about turning the lens on the people, sometimes they turned the lens on the country itself, capturing moments of change where the old world met the new.
The man on the moon shot, that was taken in 1969 in Dublin with his old newspaper seller saying, "All well in moon craft." That was the Apollo 2, I think. But it's timeless.
Another iconic shot is of a line of people queuing up outside a cinema advertising the film Love Story, starring Ryan O'Neill. A single coy nun is the only face you can make out in the shot.
Yeah, I think there's a great innocence about this image. Innocence about that era, actually. When Ireland was discovering that there was a world outside itself. And, yeah, I'd say they're all queuing up to see Ryan O'Neill. But it's a funny, there's great humour in there.
One of Anthony's favourite shots is a picture that's not actually in the Little Museum of Dublin. But it does help explain where Bill's passion for people and place came from after his wife passed away in the 60s.
There's a wonderful photograph of he and his wife bicycling through a wood in Wicklow. And I asked him how he took it, and he had it on a timer, you know. And it just captured the light and their duality vanishing into the distance. An extraordinary photograph. And when his wife died, he cut himself off from his immediate family and embraced, you know, life around him and threw himself into his work.
A lot of the subjects, the scenes and the stories that Bill's photos captured have long since disappeared as the city has changed so much. However, Bill never complained or lamented these changes. He just did his best to capture them.
Yes, he was a witness. He was a witness, but not a judge. So he became a sort of incidental documentarian of Dublin street life over between the 70s and the year 2000, which is when we published his Images of Dublin.
Bill Doyle passed away in his home very suddenly in 2010. But you can still see his stunning photographs of Dublin street life on display in the Little Museum of Dublin. Did you miss him?
Yes, God, you'd miss his. His great humour and his smile, yeah. He just had a fantastically engaging personality and a bright eye and whimsical and wicked and, you know, always with an eye out for street life, which is what he became famous for, really.
Julian Clancy was reporting there on the life and work of the late Bill Doyle. Bill was remembered in that piece by his friend Anthony Farrell, the founder of Lilliput Press, which published two collections of Doyle's work. Here's the Thing is funded by the Broadcasting Authority of Ireland with the television licence fee. We just want to quickly mention, by the way, a lecture series that's starting at Trinity College in Dublin. It's called Out of the Ashes, and it welcomes to Dublin world-leading experts on cultural loss. The first free public lecture in the series comes from Ismail Ismail Seligeldin, the founding director of the new Library of Alexandria in Egypt. He'll be speaking about reimagining the ancient library, which was lost to antiquity, for the 21st century. That's at 6:30 p.m. in the Thomas Davis Theatre in Trinity, and we'll put those details on our website. After the break, language, life and death in 19th century Ireland, as we look back at the infamous Mamtrasna murders case.
Follow us on Twitter at RTE History Show.
It's 136 years this month since the sentencing of Miles Joyce, who was convicted in 1882, one of three sentenced to death for the infamous Mamtrasna murders. Miles Joyce, or Muellra Shoiga, as he would have called himself, was of course posthumously pardoned by President Higgins earlier this year. I'm joined in studio by Professor Margaret Kelleher of University College Dublin. She's the author of the new book, The Mamtrasna Murders, Language, Life and Death in 19th Century Ireland. Margaret, you're very welcome indeed to the programme. The purpose or the point of the title of the book is that famously Miles Joyce was a monoglot, an Irish speaker who spoke no English and did not have the benefit of the services of an interpreter at his own trial.
That's right, Miles. And it's, I think, a case that continues to trouble us and to occupy us 136 years later. In the research that I was doing into the trial, I found that there was an interpreter in court, a man called Evans, who was a local Galway man, a member of the RIC, who was pressed into service to work as an interpreter. But part of the tragedy of the case for Miles Joyce is that although he was made available to translate some of the evidence against Miles Joyce, he wasn't made available to translate for this man who was accused, and we now know to have been innocent of what was charged against him.
Now, the murder case that led to his execution is incredibly complicated. And one of the reasons why it's incredibly complicated is that it's full of Joyces. There are three sets of Joyces, three distinct families, all interrelated. But if you can give us just as brief a summary as you can without confusing yourself, me and our audience.
Absolutely. And in fact, one of the things that's most important, I think, for me in this book is a cast of characters. As you say, there are three sets of families. The victims, the Joyce family, would have been known locally as the Mortines. And again, I think it's an important reminder that what's at the heart of this case are a series of brutal murders. The murder of John Joyce, his wife, his elderly mother, who was about 80 years of age, and John Joyce's teenage children, aged 14 and 17. And indeed, another child, Patsy, age 8, was left for dead. The other Joyces, I suppose particularly famous in this, would have been the accused Muellra Joyces. That would have included, the Muellra Joyces were the witnesses for the prosecution, and they were sets of first cousins. And then the final set of Joyces, as you said, were the Seans, Miles Joyce. I think the detail which interestingly came to light only in the course of the trial is that we have three sets of first cousins. We have Joyce victims, we have the prosecution witnesses, and we have the accused. And that's a detail that would preoccupy yet another Joyce, yeah. James Joyce, many years later.
Indeed. Now, the witnesses, the so-called witnesses or informers or whatever you want to call them, known locally as the Muellra Joyces, they probably saw something, but they certainly did not see Muellra Joyce anywhere near the scene of the atrocity at Mamtrasna. And there was a feud, basically, between those two families, wasn't there?
That's right. One of the details that really reverberates down through the ages is the detail given, in fact, by the boy who died, Michael, and by the boy, Patsy, who survived, which is that the men had blackened faces. And that's one of the details that reverberates and resonates. And indeed, at many moments, as I've shown in the book, was actually actively suppressed by the prosecution. It was a detail that could not be revealed, because on one hand, we had the detail by the surviving boy that the men women had blackened faces, and yet on the other hand we had the prosecution witnesses arguing that actually from quite a considerable distance they could identify without any hesitation every single member of the murder party. And that clash between prosecution witnesses who were claiming to be able to identify everyone involved and the detail of the surviving boy who was unable to identify is a key detail. And one, for example, that preoccupied Tim Harrington, the campaigner, the activist, who as early as 1884 made his allegations as to who was accused and who was guilty.
One of the interesting features, I think, of the murders is the means chosen to dispatch the victims, with the exception of the smallest boy, Patsy. The male members were shot, the female members were bludgeoned. So does that mean that the women were not worth even wasting a bullet on?
Oh dear, as I say, the brutality of it again is something that I think anyone reading the case comes back to over and over again. The men, as you say, were shot, the older men were shot, the women were bludgeoned to death. And it comes back to your question, and I think the question that so many people still have all these decades later, as to can this murder be accounted for or can it be explained? One of the pieces of folklore that survives in the Folklore Commission in UCD down into the 1930s is a detail that the men had gone to kill John Joyce, and that on the way out of the house they heard one of the women saying to the other had they recognised the murderers, and the woman said yes, and the men went back to kill all involved. I suppose in a way one can see folklore as a way of trying to account for it, a way to justify what can't at all be justified. All these years later, and again I'm very grateful to the help of Johnny Joyce, the great grandson of the murdered man, and his efforts over the years to try and find an explanation for this, it seems in a way that Tim Harrington's arguments way back in 1884 were true, that this was in many ways a local feud. It was also really about consolidation of holdings, not unlike the wonderful work that has been done recently by Brandal MacSivna in post-famine Donegal, that this is a period where many people were beginning to consolidate holdings, often at the expense of each other. John Joyce, the murdered man, had married a woman with land. He was adding this to his existing holdings. And by doing that, he had become increasingly in conflict with a character who's rarely named in this, a man called Big John Casey, but in fact was named in print by Tim Harrington in 1884. Quite extraordinary. 2 years after the murders, when five men were languishing in jail, a man who was an MP at the time could put in print those whom he believed, and I think history has proven him to be right, to be guilty and innocent. And certainly one of the enduring tragedies of this is that the man who was most guilty remained at large.
Tell us a little bit about some of the bad guys in the story. One in particular, a man called George Bolton, who was the Crown prosecutor, and what his role was in all of this.
Bolton's role is infamous, and it's also a place where the issue of language, which preoccupies me so much in the book, I think comes very firmly into play. Bolton persuaded two of the 10 accused to turn Queen's evidence, what we would call approvers, two men called Anthony Philbin and Thomas Casey. And of course, part of the reason why language is so important here, and one of the reasons I think why the case is such an important one for a wider cultural story in 19th century Ireland, which is of course the shift from being an Irish speaking country predominantly to being predominantly English, is that when we look at the 10 men accused of the Mam Traston murders, we find a startling range. Miles Joyce, as you said, was a monolingual who didn't have proper interpretive services made available to him in court. But on the other end of the spectrum, we have Anthony Philbin and Thomas Casey, who'd moved back and forth to England as seasonal workers, and in fact were very comfortable in speaking English. And it's in a way that asset, so to speak, equipped them to negotiate with Bolton, who quite infamously persuaded them, certainly in the case of Anthony Philbin, to give false evidence against the accused.
I mean, Bolton would have been well aware of the fact that at least one of the three people who were hanged had nothing to do with the case.
One can trace that exactly throughout the the papers, and indeed in Spencer's papers as well.
That he was the Lord of Tennant.
That's right. And indeed, even a sense, I think, in the court of the day, that even to those who were present, who were observing, and crucially, those who were reporting on the case, there's a very strong sense, I think, throughout that Miles Joyce was innocent.
Three men were hanged. Miles Joyce was one of the three. The other two, shortly before they were hanged, actually wrote statements exonerating Miles Joyce and saying he had absolutely nothing to do with it. Why, therefore, was he hanged?
That's right. Patrick Joyce and Patrick Casey, on the eve of their own execution, stated very clearly, and those documents are still to be seen in the National Archives, that Miles Joyce was hanged. I think there was a sense, particularly in Spencer, that awful line, the law must take its course, that it was impossible to go back, despite, for example, a very moving petition published on behalf of Miles Joyce's widow in the days beforehand, memorials from some of the leading citizens in Dublin. There was an outcry at the time that Miles Joyce was innocent. But, and perhaps we have cases, you know, closer to our own time that can show that sometimes a legal process will not admit its own failures.
OK, we're going to hear an extract now from the Daily Express newspaper account of the trial. This is a description of how Miles Joyce reacted to the guilty verdict. And we can assume also that he would have had only a very dim idea of what was going on before he was informed by his RIC interpreter that he had been found guilty.
The prisoner received the dread announcement with visible trepidation. It was communicated to him through the interpreter, the translated question, if he had anything to say on why judgment of death should not be passed upon him. He poured forth quite a torrent of words in his native tongue. His attitude was that of a man deeply, terribly excited. With head turned upwards, he stood rigidly erect, his outstretched arms accompanying to gesture the energetic, voluble language. He protested, before God and the Virgin, his utter innocence of the crime. The facility with which he spoke, the strange but sonorous sounds of his mountain Gaelic, made a remarkable impression on the court.
Would you think it was unusual in 1882 to find somebody in Ireland who was still Irish-speaking only?
Not unusual at all, which again is one of the subjects of this book. Miles Joyce lived in an area which, according to the census in 1881, 90% of the people in the barony of Ross spoke Irish, and indeed half of those spoke Irish only. I mean, in a way, one could be mischievous and say the people who were isolated in the barony of Ross in 1881 were the 10% who were English speaking, though I think in class terms they probably saw themselves as sufficiently protected by those around them. In many ways, one of the things I'm also probing in the book is a sort of linguistic divide, because when the men, for example, the five men who were sentenced to death and whose I think fates are sometimes lost from attention, two of them died in prison, three of them served every day of the 20 years, their lives in prison were to encounter awful isolation. I found, for example, in the archives very poignant correspondence where the chaplain in Maryborough, what we'd now call Port Leash Jail, in the 1890s, was pleading with the prison board for the services of an Irish-speaking chaplain so that the men could receive the sacraments, as one might say. So we have a situation where the men had grown up in an area where Irish was the language all around them, and yet in Port Leash, some years later, they were in a prison where I found there was one prison-speaking warden. So in many ways, one of my aims of the book is to put the issue of language right back into how we think about 19th century Ireland. There's a danger, I think, that we see the change as inevitable, but instead I think what we're finding is the situation as late as the 1880s and the 1890s is very varied, and that there were areas of the country where really nothing but Irish was still spoken.
Worth pointing out that two of the men you're talking about were brothers of Miles Joyce and were as innocent as he was, and
That's
one
right.
was a nephew who was also innocent. Margaret, thank you very much indeed for joining us. The book is called The Mam Trasna Murders, Language, Life and Death in 19th Century Ireland. It's published by University College Dublin Press. And by the way, Margaret's going to be doing a free evening talk on the subject at GMIT in Castlebar on the 3rd of December. That's Monday the 3rd of December at 8 p.m. all are welcome. And that's all we've got time for on this evening's programme. We're going to be taking a break now for about a month, but we'll be back on Sunday, the 30th of December, with a special episode on the 1918 general election. My thanks tonight to Andrew Kane on sound and our researcher Liz Gillis. Our reader tonight was Mark Manning. The History Show is a Pegasus production for RTE. For now, for me, Miles Dungan, and producer Lorcan Clancy, goodbye and thanks for listening.